Roman Totenberg was a child prodigy who became a violin virtuoso and a master teacher who passed on his command of craft and his love of music and life to thousands. He was also the man you wanted to sit next to at the table because he was so funny. Roman Totenberg died this week at the age of 101, surrounded by loving family, friends, and students. We asked his daughter, Nina Totenberg, for this remembrance.
My father's death was as remarkable as his life. Last week, as word spread through the music community that he was suddenly dying, his former students began flocking to his home, driving sometimes hours through the night to get there. We even had to dissuade a Polish violinist and composer from getting on a plane for the States. There's no crying in baseball or music, and so he told these amazing musicians to play for him. No matter how accomplished they were, he was still their teacher. Eyes closed, he listened, conducting with his right hand, slowing the tempo here and there for better phrasing, or clapping to keep the tempo up, and even asking for the violin to demonstrate a piece of fingering. One former student, playing the Brahms violin concerto at his bedside, couldn't hear his whispered words, so she gently put her ear to his lips. With elegant distinctness, he said quite clearly, "The D was flat." As they left, the former students all said some version of the same thing. "He changed my life." Soloist Mira Wang, who came from China at age 19 to study with him decades ago, said simply, "My parents gave me life. He taught me how to live it." My father's career really began on the streets of Moscow during a famine when he played for bread and butter that fed his family.
And that was actually the first impression of the value of the art, what can it bring to you to survive, so to say.
Roman Totenberg made his debut as a soloist with the Warsaw Philharmonic when he was 11. Over the course of time, he would solo with every major orchestra in the U.S. and Europe, playing all the classics and premiering new works by many of the great contemporary composers, all of whom were his friends. Once, Benny Goodman even called him up on stage to jam with the band. His American debut came in 1935 with the National Symphony Orchestra playing the Beethoven Violin Concerto, which he recorded decades later. The U.S. debut was such a sensation that he was invited to the White House to play for President Roosevelt. Just weeks before, my father had played for the King of Italy at a concert so formal that he had to back off the stage so as to keep facing the monarch. At the White House, the artists were invited to the president's private residence after the performance, where Mrs. Roosevelt served each of them dinner. Reflecting on the difference, my father thought to himself, "This is the country for me." Shortly after that, he began a tour across the country, traveling by train. He was anxious to practice his English, as he told Scott Simon once on this broadcast.
I went to the dining room and was seated next to a rather charming young lady who was obviously a Texan with a nice drawl and so on. After a while, she would ask me to repeat some things and so on. And finally, she said, "I have such hard time to understand ye Yankees."
In preparing this piece, I found myself listening to some of my dad's recordings. There were hundreds of them over the years, and about a dozen in CD form. They are, quite simply, astonishing in their breadth and emotion. From the technical wizardry of Paganini to the heart-wrenching and powerful Bach Chaconne, once, after a big concert when he was in his 90s, we came home with armloads of flowers and basking in the glow of stomping, standing ovations. "You know, Ninochka," said my dad with a twinkle in his eye, "when you are very young and can do it, they scream and yell. And when you are very old and can do it, they scream and yell. I have been lucky enough to do it at both ends.
NPR's Nina Totenberg, remembering her father, Roman Totenberg, who died this week at the age of 101. You can hear Roman Totenberg play an entire Mozart sonata in concert on our website at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
You move me, Kurt. And this duet would just be an excuse to spend more time with you.
This is a clip from the hugely popular TV show Glee. It's about a high school glee club. And in that scene, Blaine, who's played by Darren Criss, declares his love for Kurt, who's played by Chris Colfer. Now, what you didn't hear was their kiss, which became one of the most talked-about moments of that season. And Glee is just one of many shows on TV right now that feature gay characters. And Edward Schiappa, a professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota, has been looking into this. For the past decade, he's been studying the correlation between more gay characters on TV and public attitudes about gays and lesbians.
Really, with the emergence of the extraordinarily popular Will and Grace show, more and more Americans, sort of from the safety of their armchair, could learn a bit about gay people who they might not otherwise have learned from real life.
That was a turning point, Will and Grace, you say, even though there were gay characters on television before Will and Grace premiered in 1998, but that was a turning point.
I think there was a turning point simply because of two factors. One is it was enormously popular. So the popularity of that show and the fact that there were two major gay male characters in the show who were very different allowed the show to do what I call important category work. And what I mean by that is, you know, there were some critics who said, well, Will isn't gay enough and Jack's too gay. Well, actually, that's great because you learn that there's diversity within that category that you had in your head before of gay men.
Will, what do you think? Too gay?
Yeah, definitely. But the shirt's good.
So viewers saw Will, and he was this kind of straight-laced attorney, and Jack was more sort of flamboyant. But, I mean, they were characters, they were likable, and people could identify with them in some way, even if they weren't gay or they didn't know gay people.
Right. And what our research found was that a couple ingredients, if you will, can lead to attitude change. One of those ingredients is, which you just nailed, is, you know, are they likable or are they trustworthy? Are they attractive? There's research that says if they're attractive, it can influence your attitudes. The other part of the mix is, are you learning things through their behaviors and observing them that you didn't know about that category beforehand? If so, then the more complicated your category of whatever it is, lesbians, gay men, the less likely you are to reduce them down to a stereotype.
When Ellen DeGeneres came out on her show Ellen in 1997, and of course in real life, that was a big deal. I mean, that was a huge sort of television moment.
Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say I'm gay?
Yes, it was a big deal. It was a certainly symbolic breakthrough, but I think that there was a lot of other heavy lifting left to be done, which at least in part has been done.
Let me ask you about the show Modern Family. This is the most popular show in the United States today. Not only does it prominently feature a gay couple, but a gay couple that has a child and is in the process of adopting a second child.
Cam, what's the scribble on the Vanity Fair about an adoption agency?
Oh, yeah, they called to say they wanted to reschedule our home visit.
When? Why didn't you tell me that this is kind of important?
Well, when does it say?
Who knows? It disappears into Jennifer Aniston's hair. You gotta get a better system.
There is nothing wrong with my system. Ask me anything about any upcoming event and I can tell you when and where it is.
When is the adoption agency visit?
Okay, is that a five or a curl? Oh, I hope Jen's finally found love.
This is a show that's won awards from Catholic organizations. Mitt Romney has talked about Modern Family as a show that he really likes. It seems to attract wide appeal, and yet it does have a gay couple at its core.
The idea of there being a gay couple who have children is much more in the mainstream now than it certainly has been recognized at almost any time prior to that. So there's no question that that show is doing what I've described before as category work. It's changing our understanding of what gay men are like, and particularly as parents.
Now that we're increasingly seeing gay married couples on TV, not just in Modern Family, but also in Grey's Anatomy, this seems to be more and more of a trend. And apparently next season, NBC will be introducing more programs that include gay married couples. What's your sense of how that is going to impact how the American public thinks about this issue?
Part of it, of course, is going to depend on how those portrayals are, because if they're not sympathetic or positively portrayed...
I mean, so far they have been.
That's right. So those portrayals, if they continue to be sympathetic, will only contribute to that larger sea change that we see across society, really, in terms of the attitudes towards gay marriage.
That's Professor Edward Chiappa. He heads the Communications Studies Department at the University of Minnesota, talking about the correlation between gay TV characters and public opinion. Professor Chiappa, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
The star of John Irving's new novel, In One Person, his 13th book, is Billy Abbott. Billy is a character who's at the mercy of his own teenage crushes, which are visited upon a whole repertory company of gender-bending characters. And it is a repertory company. Billy spends many a day backstage at the local theater, where his family members are regulars. For instance, his grandfather.
Harry Marshall played all kinds of women. My grandfather loved the theater, and I loved watching him perform. But perhaps there were folks in First Sister, Vermont, who had rather limited imaginations. They knew Harry Marshall was a lumberman. They couldn't accept him as a woman. I told Grandpa Harry about watching some of our fellow townspeople who were caught in the act of watching him. "You know what I say, Bill?" Grandpa Harry asked me. I say, "You can make believe what you want." There were tears in my eyes then because I was afraid for myself, not unlike the way, as a child, I had been afraid backstage for Grandpa Harry. I stole Elaine Hadley's bra because I wanted to wear it, I blurted out. "Ah, well, that's a good fellow's failing, Bill. I wouldn't worry about that," Grandpa Harry said. It was strange what a relief it was to see that I couldn't shock him. Harry Marshall was only worried about my safety, as I'd once been afraid for his.
In One Person is a coming-of-age novel in which that person, Billy Abbott, grows up relationship by relationship, some with women, some with men, some with people who may be a bit of both. We asked John Irving, who recently turned 70, about the effect desire can have at a young age.
There's a moment, I think, in most of our childhood years, those prepubescent bordering on puberty years. Those aren't the easiest parts of ourselves for many of us to remember. But I remember that in my imagination, I was at one time or another attracted to just about everyone, to my friends' mothers, to girls my own age, even to some older boys on the wrestling team. Well, as it turned out, I liked girls, but I think a part of our tolerance for sexual differences surely comes from being honest about what we remember of ourselves. So I just tried to be, in this novel, faithful to what utter havoc the mutability of gender can be for many young people in their formative years.
This novel takes place against a backdrop of a lot of references to great works of theater, including Shakespeare and Ibsen. What was it about these works that appealed to you when telling this story of identity?
I got my storytelling from the theater. My mother was a prompter in a small town theater, and I did grow up much as Billy does, backstage. As a child, every play I saw, I had seen in rehearsal, sometimes for months. I knew everything that happened. I knew what the actors said before they spoke their lines. People have commented, sometimes with irritation, sometimes nicely, on the amount of foreshadow that there is in my novels. Well, yeah, it's not so hard to foreshadow what's coming when you know what's coming. When you are writing to, as I do, a predetermined ending. I begin my novels knowing what happens. I write endings first. I write last sentences, sometimes last paragraphs first. I write collision course stories. There is always something coming that the reader anticipates. What you can't know is when and who the casualties will be and who the survivors will be. But you see the what. You know what's coming. The collision that's coming in one person, I think it's pretty evident in the early going. You're hearing a story about the development and the growing self-awareness of a bisexual boy. It's the 1950s and 60s, and you know you are listening to the voice of an older man who is, he tells you, almost 70. You know that many of these characters you're meeting are going to coincide with the AIDS epidemic. You just don't know when or how or who's going to come out the other side and who isn't. That's not a surprise.
Is it different to write about sexuality when you're in your 70s than, say, when you're in your 30s?
Well, maybe you can be a little more forthright or a little more honest about it because you no longer have anything to protect. You're past that time in your life where you're imagining yourself as sexually attractive to someone. I just think as an older person, you can be more candid with yourself about who you were and how thoroughly intimidating and confusing and conflicted the world of adult sexuality seemed when you were on the doorstep of it but still standing outside.
Mr. Irving, you're perhaps the only novelist I know who's in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. What do you find so continually fascinating about wrestling?
Many of my wrestling friends find it odd that I'm a writer, just as many of my friends in the writing world find it odd that I was for so many years a wrestler and a wrestling coach. But they seem very similar to me. In both cases, you have to be devoted to tireless repetition and small details for many more hours than you will ever be in competition. You will be with a nameless workout partner, a sparring partner, drilling the same outside single leg dive, inside collar tie, hundreds upon thousands of times. Well, how many times as a writer do you, or should you, rewrite the same sentence, the same paragraph, the same chapter? If you're good, you'd never tire of that.
There's one difference that occurs to me. Wrestling is now, it's a spectator sport for you. You're still a major participant in writing. What's your next match?
Well, I began a new novel on Christmas Eve. My youngest son of three was home for Christmas, and he came into my office and said, he said, "It's Christmas Eve. What are you doing, writing a new novel?" And I said, "Yes, I think I am, actually. I think I just have." So I don't intend to stop dropping dead at my desk sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
John Irving, his 13th novel, is In One Person. Mr. Irving, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Months after safety advocates embraced wearing helmets during tornadoes, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued guidelines on the practice. The CDC says there's not yet enough scientific evidence to fully endorse the idea, but as NPR's Russell Lewis reports, the agency is warming up to people wearing helmets when severe weather threatens.
Since a horrific outbreak of tornadoes killed more than 250 people last year in Alabama, safety advocates have been on a crusade.
Is that it, or do you think you need a bigger one?
At a recent minor league baseball game in Birmingham, advocates handed out dozens of free bicycle helmets, but they weren't for play. They're to be used during tornadoes. Experts say several adults and children who wore helmets during last year's storms were saved because of them. Event organizer Renee Crook says when people choose to live in weather-prone areas, they need to be ready.
Preparedness is what we're preaching, preparedness. It's all about being prepared. Our motto, our slogan is, don't be scared, be prepared. Make a helmet part of your safety plan.
Up until this month, the idea of making a helmet part of a tornado safety plan was not something government health officials ever talked about publicly, although many people die in tornadoes from head injuries.
What we're concerned about is that people might spend time looking for a helmet rather than seeking appropriate shelter and finding the safest place to be during a tornado.
That's Linda DeGudis, director of the CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention. After a report broadcast on NPR, the CDC is now talking about helmets and advising people on how to make them part of their safety plan. Even still, there's not enough research on the issue, says DeGudis.
Since we don't have the evidence that demonstrates whether helmets are effective or, if they are effective, what kind of helmet would be effective, people may not be protecting themselves as much as they might think they are.
Some of the research is happening now in Alabama. One study is about to be published in a peer-reviewed medical journal. Doctors at Children's Hospital of Alabama say of the 60 patients they treated for storm-related injuries on April 27th of last year, two-thirds had head trauma. Mark Baker co-authored the study and says it's the first step to provide evidence to other medical experts about the benefits of wearing helmets.
We'll start to see changes in family preparedness for severe storms and tornadoes over the course of several years, and the events over the last year, I think, have gone a long way towards increasing awareness and improving public safety.
Baker applauds the CDC for clarifying its position. He says it took years for people to start wearing seatbelts, and it may take time for helmets to catch on. The CDC's Linda DeGudis cautions helmets don't provide total protection.
You know, there's a number of kinds of injuries that people can suffer in tornadoes, from flying debris, from being thrown around, from being hit by something or thrown into something. So there certainly are other parts of the body that can be injured besides the head.
Still, for safety advocates like Renee Crook, wearing a helmet in severe weather just makes sense. She's continuing her campaign to hand out helmets across Alabama and raise awareness in hopes people can be safer the next time tornadoes threaten the state. Russell Lewis, NPR News, Birmingham.
Liz Winstead has always looked at life a little differently. As a little girl growing up in Minnesota, she was often upbraided for asking impertinent questions and saying something inappropriate. It served her well when she became a comedian. She's written a book of essays called Liz Free or Die that takes readers through the different chapters of her life, growing up, becoming a comic, helping to create The Daily Show back in 1996, which has since gone on to huge success. But she had a showbiz debut that could have been her last performance.
It is possibly the greatest horror story and the greatest gift that I have received in my career in comedy.
It was Minneapolis in the 1980s. Liz Winstead was hosting the finals of an air guitar contest called The Great Pretenders.
And so I was wearing this big white Madonna ball gown that I got at a thrift store that was kind of ripped up. And behind me was a gigantic video screen to where the performers were waiting, and then the screen would roll up and they would sing. So I'm about to introduce the first act. The screen rolls up and the dress rolls up in the screen behind me.
Liz Winstead found herself vulnerable and exposed, nude from the waist down, and trapped in the machinery. So, she told a joke, then another. Suddenly, the audience was laughing with her, not at her. Some people even thought she'd planned it that way. A career in comedy was launched. Liz Winstead grew up one of five children of conservative Catholic parents, and, like a lot of kids, she says she loved her Barbie doll. But Barbie didn't mean impossibly perfect pulchritudinous plastic beauty to young Liz, but something different.
You know, I looked at Barbie as sort of the pinnacle of freedom, where she had her own dream house, she had a car, she had a boyfriend that I could choose when he showed up.
And what he was wearing.
That's exactly right. And so being the youngest of five kids and never getting my voice in anyway, I looked at her as somebody to completely emulate. And I didn't really even notice the crazy, curvy, plastic doll that people have come to, feminists have come to, you know, take on. And I remember being in college and taking a feminist studies class early on, and Barbie was under assault. I was like, but wait, isn't Barbie a feminist? Like, I completely perceived her as a feminist, even though her feet, she couldn't walk, but she could drive.
How did you find out you were funny?
Well, it's genetic in my family. My father is from Mississippi and a long line of storytellers, and all of my siblings are incredibly gifted at telling stories. And I think for years I knew that I had a funny bone, but stand-up comedy or pursuing comedy as a career never occurred to me, simply because in my coming of age, when I would turn on The Tonight Show, I didn't see any women really on television doing stand-up, unless they were older women like Toni Fields or Joan Rivers. And so I didn't see anyone like me. It was either men in suits talking about what men in suits talk about, or women, if they were older, talking about how much their husbands disappointed them and sort of the level that their boobs had sunk to on their body. That was a very popular thing to talk about for a lot of comedians back in the day. And so it wasn't until I was watching George Carlin one night with a girlfriend of mine, and she said, why don't you try that? And I said, I don't know. Do you think I could? And she said, why not? I wasn't really like a goofball or didn't really tell jokes as a kid. I think more in high school did I realize it's easier to be funny than it is to be angry. Because there's this interesting thing. If you make someone laugh, you have a bond. And so if you can make someone laugh who you disagree with, they have to acknowledge that on some level they like you, and sometimes then you can work things out.
Some of the most moving sections of your book have to do with your father's last days.
Yes.
And you invent a word that I have grown to admire since reading it, dilarious.
Yes, dilarious. Laughing with or at the expense of someone who is dying. And it is a word that I didn't ever use until my father passed away. My father was this amazing, funny Southern storyteller, and our politics were diametrically opposed. He was a staunch Reagan Republican, and I'm a crazy liberal. And we found this fun detente where we would watch Jeopardy together. Because if we both could answer, what is the Sudetenland, at the same time, then we couldn't call each other dumb. And he always said to me, he said, you know, I raised you kids to have an opinion, and I forgot to tell you it was supposed to be mine. Which is such a brilliant thing. And so about 6 months before he passed away, he sent me this beautiful card. And on the inside it said, I love you. You are my favorite. Don't tell the others. And I thought, oh, my God. The problem with the card is that he said on the card, don't open this until I'm gone. And finally, when he passed away, we were all sitting in the room, and my mom said, oh, your father really was excited to send you cards. I would love to hear what the card said. And I said, you know, Mom, maybe another time, maybe after the funeral, we can all read the cards. And so she goes, and I want you to start, Liz. And I was gobsmacked. And so I said, okay, the card said, I love you. You're my favorite. And then everyone else chimed in, don't tell the others. He had sent the exact same card to all of us and actually planned with my mom so that he could, upon his death, the first thing we would do is laugh and not cry.
Your mother sounds like an extraordinary character.
Yeah. She was one of those mothers who, she was never overtly critical. She was very Minnesota backhanded critical. But she always did support me in a way that was pretty incredible. She would defend me to the death, take my pictures when I was on the TV because they didn't have a VCR, and then show those pictures, or cut out clippings when I was in the paper. If I was like a young comic and I was booked as And Others, it was like Louis Anderson and Others, she would cut out And Others, put that in a box. And I think part of it, too, was I grew up with conservative parents in a very progressive community in Minneapolis, and so she would say things to me in her later years in the retirement and say, well, you know, sometimes at my dinner table at the retirement home, they sit me with the Democrats, and I've said I'd rather sit with the Alzheimer's people. And so yeah, she was quite a character in her own right. Very different sensibility than my dad. But, you know, it was, again, just lucky to have these gifts from these parents who reiterated how much humor was part of us and how important it was to keep it going. Now I feel like I have a legacy that I'm carrying on.
Liz Winstead. Her new collection of essays, Liz Free or Die, speaking from New York. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. In 1919, Chicago was called the youngest great city in the world. The First World War had just ended. The troops were coming home. Industry was booming. And crime in that city was way down. And yet, right in the thick of it, disaster. 12 days that shook that city right at the height of the summer of 1919. Gary Crist writes about it in his new book. It's called City of Scoundrels. And at the time, Chicago's mayor, William Hale Thompson, he was known as Big Bill Thompson, had just been reelected, and he was pushing an ambitious infrastructure project that would reshape the city forever.
He was this extremely colorful, extravagantly corrupt blowhard who always wore this cowboy hat. And he liked to think of himself as the people's David, defending the common Chicagoan against the Goliaths of wealth and privilege. But he really was a big champion of the Chicago Plan projects, you know, which allowed for a lot of kickbacks and patronage, so it was understandable. But he called himself Big Bill the Builder, and he really embraced this project.
Widely regarded as the worst mayor in Chicago's history. Well, and somebody, by the way, reading the book, who reminded me of another Illinois politician who will not be named.
Right. He's very much in that tradition.
You get to the summer, anybody who's been in Chicago during the summer knows it is a hot place. We're talking about 1919, so no air conditioning.
It was a hot July. The soldiers were returning from Europe.
Looking for jobs.
A lot of the jobs had been taken by the influx of African-American workers who had come.
We're in the middle of the Great Migration.
At the beginning of the Great Migration. They had come up to fill these jobs during the wartime labor shortage. And so they're all converging on the city just when the economy was winding down from its wartime peak. So there was really intense competition for jobs, for social services, and especially for housing. All of these tensions were just coming to a head in July of 1919 when the city was hit by this bizarre series of mishaps.
It begins shortly before 5 p.m. on Monday, July 21st, 1919. What happens that day?
A Goodyear blimp was making an exhibition flight over the city. It mysteriously caught fire and crashed in the downtown loop. It came through the skylight right into the central courtyard of the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank. And it ended up killing a number of people inside. And
13 people, you write.
13 people. And it sort of set off a wave of hysteria in the city. People just thought, if you're not safe working in the middle of a bank, where are you safe?
So that happens, and it kind of dominoes into a series of unrelated but horrendous events that take place over the next 12 days. The next day, a couple from another part of Chicago arrived to a police station in the Gold Coast area, John Wilkinson and his wife. They're immigrants from Scotland. Their 6-year-old daughter is missing.
Yeah, she was on the street coming home from a park with her friends and said goodbye, and that was the last anybody ever saw of her. And for days, the whole city was consumed with the mystery of this disappearance. She was a very popular little girl. And when it turned out that it was a seemingly innocuous neighbor who was the culprit and that he had actually kidnapped and killed her and then buried her body in his own basement, that sort of set off another wave of hysteria about whether one's friends and neighbors could be trusted.
The headlines blared across the newspapers, right?
Oh, yeah. It was making the biggest headlines during the actual period.
The next day, July 27th, 1919, the most significant series of events breaks out in Chicago. Some young African-American boys are rafting along the lakefront. They drift toward a whites-only beach accidentally. Stones are thrown at them. Shots are fired. One of the boys is hit in the head and drowns, and thus begins a series of race riots, white mobs ransacking black neighborhoods in Chicago for days.
Right. It really just spiraled into a five-day orgy of violence that was really revolting in many ways. The police seemed incapable of doing anything about it. There were rumors that some of the white rioters were politically protected, and so the police weren't touching them. This was considered one of the first race riots in history where blacks really aggressively fought back. Hmm. And this was seen as a positive by many black leaders.
Talk about that resistance for a moment.
Well, there was this sense among the black community that black soldiers had performed in a stellar fashion in the war in Europe. And they had come back, and they were ready to claim their rights as American citizens. And what do they get? They get race riots and abuse. So there was this rising, they called it the New Negro sensibility, this rising sense of pride and sense of entitlement to respect and to the basic rights that everyone else in the country was guaranteed. So that created a volatile background to the violence on the street.
It got to the point where Mayor Thompson, Big Bill Thompson, had to call in the National Guard.
Yes, he was reluctant to do this, but finally things got so bad that he blinked first and he said, even though I don't like going to the governor, I will write out this written request. And within hours, there were thousands of troopers heading into the streets with howitzers and rifles and bayonets, and they met a lot of resistance, but really within 24 hours, they had more or less restored order.
I'm speaking with Gary Crist. He's the author of a new book. It's called City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. Gary, this period of 12 days also claimed many lives. How many people died, by the way?
38 people died. There were over 500 injured, and thousands were left homeless because there were a lot of fires at the end.
What kind of impact did this have on the history of racial politics in Chicago, which has been a difficult one, to say the least?
Yeah, certainly it did change race relations in the city for years to come. There was understandably a lot of bitterness after the riot, and it really had the effect of hardening the color line that had just really been developing in the city over the previous few years. So it really left a legacy of residential segregation in Chicago that lasted for decades, and some would say the legacy is still there.
What about the plan to redevelop Chicago? Whatever happened to it?
Interestingly enough, one of the effects of the crisis was Mayor Thompson came out stronger than ever. And since he was such a big champion of the Chicago plan, I think a lot more of the Chicago plan did get finished. And so a lot of the architectural gems that make Chicago such a showpiece today, you know, the Navy Pier, the Magnificent Mile, the Michigan Avenue Bridge, the park system, all of these were kind of a legacy of this mayor who is a joke in some circles.
That's writer Gary Crist. His new book is called City of Scoundrels. It's about the 12 days of disaster that gave birth to modern Chicago. The book is now out. Gary, thank you so much for coming in.
Happy to be here.